Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, you and I meet another woman who is living her life, following her own path, and making a difference. Today's guest is Charisse Beach, an author, educator, entrepreneur, and national presenter. Charisse Beach, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you, Pamela. It's really good that you're having me on your show. I appreciate that.
Well, I am very pleased that you were available. You've had so many experiences and so many things that you have and are doing. So why don't we just dive right in? You served as principal of Joliet, a regional safe school program. A principal of Premier Academy Joliet. A regional safe school program designed to provide alternative education for at-risk and high school students in Joliet, Illinois. That sounds like quite a handful.
It was, but I was totally up for the challenge. Having raised an alternative style child, my youngest son, who had pretty much a lot of problems in school and later turned into more mental health issues that we can get into later.
Okay.
So he prepared me for that job, and that job then prepared me for life moving forward to help many different people in many different stages of their life. So I'm forever grateful for that opportunity.
Well, I tell you what, let's back up even further and let's start with where you were born and where you grew up.
Okay. I was born on the south side of Chicago. My parents, Robert and Ollie, were just wonderful, very basic, blue-collar working people. And the values that they instilled in me are the values that I believe make me the woman that I am today. I attended public school for a very brief time, and then my parents put me in parochial school, which was junior high through high school. And the high school, I always laughed because I know my parents were so encouraged that I was attending an all-girl Catholic school. And I just laughed inside because I think the girls' Catholic school probably had more boys around us in the public schools where the boys were right there beside us. But it just made for a well-rounded upbringing in my eyesight.
So the values that your parents taught you, what did they teach you to value? What was important to them?
They had me to value family. And I'm not saying it in this order. It's just kind of like how it comes.
Okay.
Family, God, and loving yourself. And those three have always intermingled for me. And honestly speaking, they sometimes take different roles as to which comes first, which comes second, but the three are always there. So whatever stage in life that I'm in or whatever project I'm working on, those are the three values that I always fall back on to make sure that I'm carrying out the mission with fidelity.
Would you say that there was any particular person or event that really had a significant impact on you growing up?
I would have to say my mother. And it's interesting because even today, with both my parents being deceased, I play it back in my mind a lot because to the world meaning those that knew my family well, my mother and I had this extremely close relationship. And my father was the kind of father that was rather quiet, soft-spoken, kind of went along with whatever my mother thought best, and just pretty much a low-key type of guy. But what I learned much later, and really after both were gone, is that my relationship with my father is so foundational because he he is the one, our relationship is the one that I can say truthfully was unconditional. He stood behind me and loved me unconditional to anything that I may have done, thought, or believed. Whereas with my mom, there were some conditions, there were some expectations, but it didn't dampen our relationship. But as I got older, I could really see it for what it was. And I think I needed the combination of the two, again, to help me with the challenges that life would bring me later. I always feel like I can sort of live in the middle because I had both kinds of love, if that makes any sense.
It really does. And, you know, more and more in today's world, as you know, we hear more attention paid to the importance of dads in their children's lives, because for the longest time, it was mom and dad was sort of, you know, a side panel. So it's really, yeah, I think, important and good to hear you talk about the value both of your mother and your father, and from different perspectives. They were two different people, and so they brought different things to your life, which makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
What was going on in the world around you as you were growing up? Do you remember what was in the news? What were the fads? What were the important, yes, things of the day?
Like it was yesterday. I find myself reflecting on this a lot. And just to put it out there, I'm not big on politics, so I will have no comments about anything political. But one of the items in the news that I know will carry with me, well, there's a few. I go back to the day that President Kennedy was assassinated. Mm. It's like I can just recall that I was in second grade, and I used to walk home for lunch. And walking home from lunch, I get home about maybe 12:15-ish. And I believe it was about 12:30-ish that Walter Cronkite broke in on all channels to report that the president had been shot, and I think it was less than 5 minutes that he broke back on crying, saying that he was gone. And just the emotion, watching my mom, who was a stay-at-home mom, watching her go from so glad you're home, here's your lunch, how's your morning been, to just completely losing it. I just attached that to the raw emotion of when your life is impacted by greatness, and that greatness somehow just is gone in a second. Just to see her be that attached to a person that she didn't know personally, I think that had a huge impact on me, to realize that some things that are not tangible, things that you can't touch, people that you don't know, can have such a huge impact on your life. And then the other high-profile cases just followed right there with Dr. King's assassination, Robert Kennedy. I just felt completely caught up in that, and I was a school-age kid. I mean, I probably didn't have to be that caught up, but I really was, and I spent several months doing like magazine collages of all of the family, of those three families. I would just somehow see the connection of the three, and I started cutting out pictures. Even then, I was vision boarding and didn't even have a name. But I was just like totally mesmerized with those three families and the tragedies surrounding them. And that remains one of the most important times that I figure it kind of set the tone for where we are today.
As a little one, did you have an understanding of what death meant? I mean, one minute they were there and the next minute they weren't.
I did. For some reason, I had this rather morbid fascination with dying, death, dead bodies. And some of that is because my paternal grandmother, who was, like today we have so many grandmothers that are in their 30s and 40s, but back then not so much. So my grandmother was pretty much up in age. So And I spent a lot of time with her. So her friends were aging and some were dying. And I was always the go-to person. She would always ask, Sharice, Sister so-and-so passed at the church. Do you want to go with me? And I'd be like, yes. You know, I don't know why. I was just really encouraged by that. So I got to see it from an unemotional standpoint, I would tap into the emotions of the families connected to the deceased. And I was always observing that, and I just remember then and now, my mantra became, Lord, I don't want to be on that front seat, because the front seat is always the family, and that's where you see the people grieving the hardest. And as long as I didn't have to be on the front seat, it was a nice outing with my grandmother. So, yes, I understood when the president, the governor, and Dr. King were dying or dead and had gone. I understood exactly what that meant. It, to me then, as a child, it was finality. It was a movement has ended.
As a child, do you think that any of the, when you think of the totality of your childhood, if you will, did it inform any of the ideas that you began to have about who you would be as a grown-up?
Yes, definitely. And I don't think they were any more unusual or maybe just as typical as most kids growing up. You start to have that mindset of what works well for you as a kid and what's not working well. So as you grow up, you decide that you adopt certain behaviors that your parents demonstrated that worked well for you. You would say, oh, I'm going to be just like that when I grow up because I like how it makes me feel as a 10-year-old or as a 14-year-old. And then the things that you weren't happy with, or the challenging type of behaviors, I remember saying, oh God, when I have children, I would never be like that, or I would never say that to my child. So I definitely took on, you know, those type of tones. And to this day, I can truthfully say I was able to carry those through, but also typically we do take on those characteristics of our parents, whether we like them or not, because again, If you're raised in a home where there are other values and they don't change, they stay the same regardless of the circumstances, they are embedded in you whether you like it or not.
Indeed. Tell us about your early work experiences.
Oh, that was always interesting. I was a bossy child. Of course, I never believed that, but that's what my parents...
Of course not.
Some of my parents, yeah, of course I didn't see that. But according to my mom, I was always bossing the other kids around in the neighborhood. When I would go out to play, she would always watch me, and then I would be having kids lined up, and I'd be instructing them. So early on, my mother said, you are going to be a teacher. And I was fine with that. I was like, okay, I always admired. I had a couple of teachers that I just thought that the sun rose and set on them. So having that path to look forward to, I was very encouraged by that. So I went to school and went into the coursework to become an educator. And then once I got out, I don't know why, I decided that I wanted to go more into a business setting. But I didn't have a business setting background. So I tried my hands at a few things. Something as starting off with was a manager of a McDonald's. You know, once you come out with a degree, you don't have to start off as the fry cook, but you have to learn all those stations.
Right.
So that gave me the managerial part that I felt I wanted, and it was okay, but I realized that I didn't have any passion for that. You know, I liked the managerial part of it, but I had no passion for cooking food, smelling the food, watching it being packaged up. So I said, okay, this is not for me. And then I went into a beauty school position as a registrar, which is sort of like a human resource type of responsibilities, but you're registering students, not so much employees. So I enjoyed that very much because that gave me the human aspect that I like, you know, being able to kind of help mold a person that's starting out in something with some ground level ideas and concepts that, you know, should help them be successful in their journey to become cosmetologists. So that was good, but again, it still didn't spark any passion in me. So then I finally decided, okay, let me just go into the job that I went to school for and let's see where it goes. And then I quickly realized that I really did need to be working with kids and working with other educators. And that's where it started for me and remained until I realized that there's so many gaps in education. And I can truthfully say, not having lived in a lot of states, I've lived in four, I can truthfully say that there's gaps no matter where you are in what an ideal education looks like. And I decided that at the point where I had done it for 9 years, that I would rather go into administration to see if I can somehow make a difference and be in on the ground level of creating a better educational system so kids could learn more realistically what they need to learn and not all of the ideals and hype that other leaders have put upon them. So that's where I started, and that is today where I am.
You refer to the term ideal education. What does an ideal education look like?
In my perfect world vision, an ideal education is where you're matching the ability and the passion that would result in the career. And I can truthfully say, having researched the educational system in Japan, I think they got it right. They track what students want to do and create the educational coursework that leads them to doing it. So they're not taking classes to feel what a state says you need to have 4 years of a particular subject, 2 years of another one, because you need to have this what they consider well-rounded understanding. But I like the idea of giving students everything that they need in order to do what it is they want. And now, to play devil's advocate, one would say, like for me as an example, well, you went to school tracked for one thing, but then you decided you wanted to do something else. So why do you feel like having those other classes that maybe you felt you didn't need, maybe that helped you? Well, my other part of the ideal education is hands-on application. For example, you become a better writer when you write. You become a better reader when you read. So you don't have to necessarily have 4 years of history or geography if that is not what you're trying to do. But if you can read and you can write, then you can think. And from being able to do those very basic things, there is nothing that you can't teach yourself to do.
That does, in fact, sound like an ideal education. Tell you what, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk more to you about what doesn't work from your perspective. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in just a moment. Therese Beach, author, educator, entrepreneur, and national presenter. We're going to come back to that on entrepreneurial part of Charisse in a little bit. But Charisse, in terms of what's not ideal with respect to education, it sounds like you are opposed to the teaching to the test, so to speak, kind of guidelines that many teachers feel restricted by, I think is a fair statement today. Is that accurate?
Most definitely, Pam. And too much testing. There's so much emphasis on standardized testing, national percentiles of where students fall. And the reality is, on any given day, a student who is a person first can come to school with the baggage, can be plagued by outside influences that will definitely affect their performance on a test, and to the better or to the worse. You can do so much better on the test for whatever reason, but that doesn't mean that you really have mastered some of those concepts or applications, and then you could do poorly and just bomb it because you had a fight with your mom, or you were sick the night before, or you haven't, your family doesn't have proper food or nutrition in the home, so you're not doing your optimal best, yet you're going to get ranked in a percentage along with kids who have completely different circumstances. So that definitely doesn't work to give a clear picture of what a student has mastered or what they need to know. What else doesn't work is that one-size-fits-all classroom setting. And I learned through having the alternative school to become a leader of so many different procedures and different philosophies, because a regional safe school has schools within a region, and in our case, it was 17 different school districts that fed into my school. So that's 17 different policies and procedures and expectations that these kids are coming to us with, yet they had to manage and fit under our one roof, but we individualized their education and the support services that they needed in order to leave us better than how they came. My book is written to address the fact that we can have that same success in the traditional classes or traditional schools without kids having to be removed if it were approached with that mindset.
Charisse, what's the name of your book?
Oh, At-Risk Students, Transforming Student Behavior.
Okay. At-Risk Students.
And I devote a chapter or two in the beginning that talks about too much testing and the fallacies of student achievement, the demographics of how minority students are not necessarily looked at among other minority students with the same demographics. It's frequently looked at across a nation, which is ridiculous. An African-American urban male is not going to perform equally to a student of non-color in a rural setting, or a student in a community setting where there's different support systems in place, where there's hierarchy and the community tagging on to police and businesses that all work together to help that child. There are communities like that. Well, that student is not going to fare the same as the student going to an urban school and coming home at the end of the day and walking past gang activity and living in poverty. Yet that's the way our kids are judged.
To the folks who say, but employers want potential workers who have the same education. Employers want to know that XYZ has been taught no matter who it is, that they've had XYZ experience no matter who it is. That's what employers want. Employers don't want to know that Sally lived here and Joe lived there and Susie had this stuff going on and it impacted her scores. What do you say to those folks?
That, and again, I devoted quite a bit of time in the book addressing that. I feel, and the research supports, where your child goes to school should be representative of what opportunities that they will get in order to be able to compete. I agree that employers are not looking for excuses and, well, this is the factor that resulted in this score. But in order to get students where they can truly compete for the jobs and have the knowledge base, if you live in a poverty-stricken community, then there needs to be resources and services there to, again, I'm going to use the term, which is real simple, to fill the gap or to create the bridge. If you look at the difference between what one community has going for it and another community has, is sometimes that is the difference in how the kids are performing on these state tests. It is not that difficult. Now, an impoverished community will not have the best teachers necessarily because teachers don't want to come to an area where they feel unsafe. So they may not, some of the better teachers, when I say better, the highly qualified, will seek employment places where they can go in and do their job and not necessarily fear for their life. But it's the impoverished communities that need the better teachers. So make it attractive for those teachers to want to work there. Offer them incentives such as more pay or pay for them to get their secondary degrees in order to get the best practices under their belt and come in and give it to the communities that need it the most. I just would like for the mindset to be wherever we see the gap or there's the bridge that needs to be built is where the federal and state dollars need to go to make that happen. And then when there's a standardized test situation, it should make it look more equitable to say that no matter where you are, you're getting the same thing, because if you need more than what another community has or what another community is getting, then you will get it because you need it more.
I see. So you really level out the playing, you even out the playing field.
Exactly.
In a way that is actually productive.
Right.
Charisse, you grew up in an intact household. You had mom and dad. They instilled values in you. You went to school. You've worked. You do a lot with children, a lot with educators. So when it comes to having and raising your own children, piece of cake, right?
No, I always refer back to, I have two sons. My oldest son is 33, and for some reason, the older we get, I forget his age. I can remember mine with no problem, but I forget his age. And so I think he's 33. I didn't even know when he became a teenager, and I know that sounds odd, but he was the type of child, and I always try to couple that with the type of person, because wherever you are, whether you are a toddler, a teenager, or a senior citizen, I believe that you formed your values or you formed a belief system early on, and that is who you are. So when my oldest son was becoming a teenager, I just saw him as this delightful kid who was in dual sports. He played basketball during basketball season and ran track during track. All of his high school was started in junior high, actually. So from 6th grade to 12, I was sitting on bleachers pretty much year-round, and it was wonderful. So when he became a teenager, and I'm talking to other parents, and they're saying about the antics going on, like, oh, yeah, Joe took the car and had a wreck, and now our insurance has gone sky high. You know, and I'm listening to stories like this, or, you know, Sam was at someone's house and the house got busted for kids smoking weed. And I'm like, oh my God. Not saying that I'm not in tune to these things happening, but if I said, oh my God, then because it's like, oh God, these are my son's friends. And he's not doing any of this. Not doing any of this. So that's why when he became 17, I had to pinch myself to make sure that I was still living and breathing, because I wasn't experiencing any of this. So I did have friends to say, oh, wow, you really have it good. Yeah, well, then there was that second child. And I always tell people that is another testimony of God. It's like God had to make sure that I never felt that I was doing it all by myself because of the first one. So when I had the second one, that brought me to my knees. So I knew God was in the mix with both of them.
What do you mean the second one brought you to your knees?
Well, the second one came out the womb with issues. When I say issues, things that brought you to a place of you can't ignore it if you have to deal with it. Prime example, what starts off as such a wonderful blessing, because having a child, no matter what the situation, is definitely a blessing. Well, my second one, Oliver, he was born on Mother's Day in 1988. That was a Sunday. I had him on Mother's Day. And it was such a joy to have a child born on Mother's Day, because that's something that you take with you forever. It's like, oh, my baby was born on Mother's Day. Well, on Father's Day, approximately 6 weeks later, my entire family was in the emergency room with him having surgery because of a pyloric gland, which I had no idea at that time what that was and what it did, but it's a gland that everyone has, but in boys more than girls, there's a condition, Staphylococcus or something like that, where that gland can begin to shrink. And that happened with Oliver. So it's one of those one out of four kids type of thing.
Okay.
Well, he was one of the four. So one out of the four. So that gland started to shrink from birth until about Father's Day, because Father's Day weekend, that's where we celebrated it. And that gland had to be opened up. So what it does is it shrinks, so he's getting no nutrients. So it's always like he's hungry, because when he's eating, because he's not getting it in, so when he's eating and the gland is closing, then he starts to spit up everything that he might have gotten in him, until about 4 weeks into having this, and the pediatrician trying everything possible to switch up, you know, the formula, Pedialyte, anything that they thought that they could do with the knowledge that they had to see if he could, you know, maintain his milk and water. Well, nothing was working. And I remember this fateful Saturday, the day before Father's Day, my mom and I had been out shopping for stuff for the baby, and the baby was at home. Oliver was at home with his dad. And when we walked in the door, my husband was fully dressed. Oliver was fully dressed, and my husband had this panicky look on his face, and he's like, he's turning blue. And I just, everything became black at that time. It's like everything went black. I just know we hurried to the ER, and there was no pediatrician. Can you imagine that? No,
no.
Pediatrician on staff that day.
That doesn't make any sense.
It's insane. But I always know, I mean, I have had so many miracles in my life besides the fact that I'm here on the phone talking to you, being one of them. But I knew at that point it was okay, that everything was going to be okay. We ended up having the most knowledgeable surgeon, who, again, was not a pediatrician, but he wasn't 100% sure, but he said, let me have some tests ran. I think I know what this is. So he took Oliver and had all these tests ran, and he came back, And he says, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the pyloric gland. That's the issue. He needs to have surgery right away, you know, because obviously he was turning blue. He wasn't getting the oxygen he needed. And so we, of course, consented. And after that, within, I would say, 3 days, Oliver was maintaining his intake. He wasn't throwing anything up. He started gaining the weight that he hadn't been able to gain and looking really good again. He started to look like he did when he was first born. He was born very healthy, 8 pounds, 3 ounces,
wow.
And then gained no weight. So mm-hmm. in a baby, when they don't gain, that's just as significant as losing. So it was truly the right diagnosis. The surgery was successful, and we were on our way. And I'm thinking, okay, this is like my miracle baby. All of these issues and everything now, I kept seeing every stage of his development. Oh, we got that behind us. Everything's going to be great. Everything's going to be good. And it was not the case.
Your life really changed in 2007.
It really changed in 2007. Again, it's my Oliver. Oliver, from age 5 on, demonstrated signs that he needed more support than we gave to my oldest son, Robert, which I never gave his name, but that's fine. His Robert.
Okay.
He needed a lot more support, and we gave it to him. We gave him everything that he needed to help him to make better choices, and I'm speaking specifically of from age 5 until, oh, God knows when, it was stealing and lying. And I won't get into the multiple instances because this would become a full day show rather than an hour. But it was multiple issues and incidents, and we had multiple interventions to counteract them, from me taking him at age 8 to see a psychologist who referred him to a psychiatrist who prescribed him as depressed. And I always said, what does an 8-year-old have to be depressed about? Which today, you know, that may not be true. There's a lot of, you know, the world is just a different place.
Indeed.
But at that time, I was the one that should have been depressed, but yet I was just barreling through. Oliver was, and still is, a stutterer. His dad is a stutterer. So what the Prozac did was slowed everything down. So we noticed after about a month of him taking the medication, wow, Oliver's barely stuttering. You know, so we realized that it has to be some of the chemical in Prozac that has slowed things down.
Okay.
Well, it slowed his speech down, but it didn't steal the stealing and lying. It didn't slow that down. So I decided that a kid 8 years old who was still having the same behavior issues, I wasn't going to just have him medicated and not receiving, you know, the results of what the medication should be doing. So I took him off, and we went along with some talk therapy for a while because I just, like many parents will say, I don't want my kid medicated. Well, we medicate kids when they have cancer, leukemia. We medicate them when they have diabetes. But for some reason, the general public, and I was guilty of it too, didn't see that medication was important, you know, to help his mind. But for me, it wasn't about medication. It was about getting the right diagnosis. And I wasn't convinced that we had it. So at age 15, he was diagnosed as having bipolar disorder. And I, to this day, we, the family, believe that to be a true diagnosis based on research and the symptoms that he had then and still has, that makes sense.
Okay.
So we went through the trial and error of medication, therapy, small successes, most of the time not. So getting to 2007, he is now graduated from an alternative high school himself, not mine, but another one in Chicago, actually. So we were very happy about that. He attempted to do a semester of college, but he wasn't on any medication at that point, and he wasn't able to focus. So he didn't do well, and he wasn't happy about that. So he had a lot of ups and downs with his mental illness. He was not doing well most of the time. So he was going from, you know, mania to depression.
Which is the hallmark of bipolar disorder, going
exactly
from one to another.
And then being 19 at that point, you know, you got so many other factors. You know, you got your peer pressure, you got what your friends are doing that you may not be able to successfully do. So he was able to hold down a couple of jobs, but again, as you just stated, spot on, the disease or disorder would always have him compromising his choices. So he would keep a job for 2 weeks, get paid, then won't go to work.
Charisse,
and, you know, because he's not making the connection. If I don't go to work, I'm not going to get paid again.
Charisse, we're going to take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, I want to pick up right here with your son, Oliver, and what that was like for him and for you. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Charisse Beach, author of At-Risk Students, Transforming Student Behavior. Just before the break, we were talking about the painful, challenging experiences that both Oliver, your son, and your family were going through. Oliver had medication, didn't want to take medication?
Yes. Off and on throughout the high school years, but I want to just throw this in, and then I remember exactly where we left off. The impetus for the book was to kind of give a timeline of some of these challenges that I went through, but to not slam the educational system, but to pretty much highlight the unpreparedness that the educational system has for students with mental health illness or mental illness or mental health disorders. The schools are not equipped to effectively deal with it. Teachers are not trained on the signs and the symptoms. And I had to live through that entire high school and after pretty much without the support, because people didn't know at the time, well, what this means, maybe you need to have this happen, or maybe you need this kind of support. It was pretty much even contacting the state when things got so challenging for us as a family. The state had so much red tape and said by the time everything got concluded with all the paperwork, he would be 17 and a half, and they couldn't do anything at that point. He'd have to be before 17 and a half. So it was like doors were closing everywhere. And that's why when I had an opportunity to actually put all of this down on paper, the goal was, I know I'm not the only person that has gone through what I've gone through. I talk to people every day who are experiencing similar challenges. So it kind of gives parents, the book is to be treated as an advocacy to help you deal with the school system if your child is not, if his or her issues are not being addressed, and to help school administrators and teachers to know what to look for so that they can better address those students. But back to 2007, where we were. So Oliver came to me after experiencing his own personal losses, more losses than successes. And he said, "Mom, I am so tired of feeling the way I feel. I want to go in and get another evaluation, and I promise this time I will follow through with whatever the doctor says I need to do." So, you know, that was like music to my ears, because for once you're taking control of your own mental health. I've been having to be in control, and you've been compromising my control along the way. But now it's like, okay, great, I can support you on your journey. So I was really happy. So we went to the ER and didn't know what to expect, but when he spoke to the staff, they found his story to be quite compelling, of how he felt and the history that he's had and things that he's done, that they admitted him immediately and put him in the psychiatric floor for an evaluation. So he was in for a week. And I could tell, I was advised to not visit, because he went from glad to be in, you know, the typical bipolar,
sure,
to lashing out, being angry as if I put him there, which I did not. So the doctor advised me to just give him that week to go through whatever. And once the medicine gets in his system, he should calm down and look at things much more rationally. And I was encouraged by that.
And, you know, even that was a miracle, because the idea of admitting him for an evaluation for a week, that just does not happen today.
Exactly. And he was at the age that he was not on my insurance, and usually everything is about how you can pay for something.
Right.
So, you know, they really found him, they found his situation to be quite compelling. But he's been with me through everything, so he knows that I don't sweep anything under the rug. My belief is, I can't help you or anyone else if I don't give the true picture and the full story. So when we would go to different doctors, I would always start from, you know, ground level zero and bring us where we are. So he did that after modeling that for me, and they were like, "Oh yeah, okay, yeah, we're going to take you right now." So I was at a point where I was really happy. And it's funny, the significance of these Mother Day and Father Day events. He was in the hospital over the weekend. That happened to have been a Father's Day weekend. And we, as a family, was just saying, now how interesting is that? It's like major turning point happens for Oliver on Father's Day, even though it was many years ago. So he gets out. I go to pick him up. He's very, very calm, very docile, very warm, because he's a warm, loving individual by nature anyway. And the doctor says these infamous words: "The best thing you can do for you and your mom, Oliver, is to not stop taking this medication. If you stop, you will be worse off than if you had never taken it." And we left out of there with our heads high and all's well. So that was in June. Pretty much the beginning, he was still quite upbeat about, you know, having the evaluation, being on this medicine. Just for the sake of our listeners, it was Risperdal. Do your own research. He started complaining to me early on that, you know, he wasn't able to sleep, and he was having a hard time eating certain foods, no matter how bland or healthy they were. He would get stomach cramps. And so we called the doctor, and he's like, "Oh, let me prescribe this. It will help coat the stomach. This is something that happens with some people, not unusual." So he's like, "Okay, fine." So now he's taking, actually this would have been the third medication at this time, because he got the Risperdal for the bipolar disorder, and then something else, I can't remember, it started with a C, to help him sleep, and then now another medication to coat his stomach. So that was three medicines that he was taking. And he wasn't getting any results from the sleep one or the coating of the stomach. But he took them. And he still obviously wanted to work. He wanted to be a normal 19-year-old, whatever that means. And he lucked up and got a seasonal job. We live in Joliet, and one of the big things in Joliet is this NASCAR racing every year. So he got a job where they would stay up all night and clean up the area, which has to be done at night because the thing goes on all day, which meant he wasn't in the position to try to sleep. So his habits had changed. And after 2 or 3 days, he decided he was having a good time. He was glad to be working, even though it was a temporary job. He took himself off the medication. So for a month and a half, the medicine had worked itself out of his system. The seasonal job was over at that point, and Oliver was pretty much back to his old ways prior to going in, which was staying up all night, hanging out, sleeping all day, so he didn't have to hear my, well, I'd be gone to work, so he'd be gone by the time I would get home, so he didn't have to have, you know, a daily confrontation with me, because whenever we had an opportunity to talk, my conversation always was the same. Honey, you need to go back to treatment. You got to get back on some meds. If it's not this, you just got to go see the doctor. You got to get back on into therapy. You've got to talk. You've got to do all of this. It all works together. He wasn't hearing anything. So I felt like I'm going to lose him if I just sit back and let him continue running amok. So what I had provided for him right after high school graduation was a vehicle that my oldest son Robert had, a vehicle that I passed down to him. So we had got it detailed, and it looked almost like new. It was paid for sure. So that was giving him like that start to, as going to adulthood, go look for a job, get to work, you know, just kind of giving him a chance. So that's what he was using to not do anything. So I decided I would take the vehicle. I had one of my staff members come and drive the vehicle, and I put it in his garage. And when I got home that night, Oliver was pacing up and down my driveway, and he says, "Mom, why did you take the truck?" I said, "Because I keep telling you to go back and get into treatment and get back on meds. You keep ignoring me, and I'm not going to just have you running around all night and sleeping all day. No. Once you go back into treatment and get on meds, you will get the truck back." And he said, "Okay, Mom, that's fine. That's fair." And I went on with my evening. So it's a beautiful August night. I'm sitting on my patio talking to my best friend. And that was my first day of teachers coming back because I work all summer. But this was like the first day for all the teachers. So it was a really good day. And it was getting dusk, and I was winding down my conversation to go in the house, and all of a sudden, out of from behind, I didn't even see him, period. He hits me across my side of my face where I had the phone up to my ear. He hits me with a 2x4, and the phone just slides across the driveway, and I'm sitting there like stunned, and the beating begins. And I pretty much said, "Okay, God, if this is the way you choose for me to go, I'm going to go with dignity. I don't know anything else I can do." At that time, my oldest son, Robert, was out of college, but he was working a little job that took him on. He didn't work that far, but he worked different hours, so I wasn't sure what time he would be home, but he wasn't home at that time. It was just Oliver and me. And he literally beat me with this 2x4 from outside to inside to the basement, which is where he got the 2x4. We were in the process of getting the basement finished.
Okay.
So there was a lot of lumber and nails and debris, kind of, you know, building debris down there. So when he was trying to take me down there, I don't know if this kid has a gun. I don't know what's going on. So it's like I had given my life to God. And I watched, nobody can attest to this but me. As I'm speaking to him, I'm not yelling. I said, "Oliver, why are you doing this?" And his eyes rolled back where I could see nothing but the white of his eyes. And he says, I heard you on the phone telling Cheryl, who's my girlfriend, that you didn't love me. So, of course, you know, I was not having that conversation.
He was hallucinating.
And he was having a delusion, a delusional psychotic break. And the eyes rolling up in his head, I knew then I was not, and I guess I found some sense of comfort to know, even though I believed I was done, I knew that it wasn't my child who was doing me in. This was the bipolar disorder that is going to take my life.
Folks, there's so much more to this chilling story. Be sure to tune in tomorrow for part two of this conversation with Cherise Beach. And I do thank you for joining us today for this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. This program is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can call 301-654-5286, but the best way to be in touch is by going to mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.